The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Once he was the conquering war hero of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Capitol Hill. General David Petraeus, former CIA director from 2011 to 2012 and former Iraq and Afghanistan commander, made a much more humble visit to the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday. After apologizing for his lapses in judgment that resulted in an extramarital affair that might have compromised national security, he moved on to discuss something equally obvious. Syria, he said, is not doing so well these days.
Syria today, Mr. Chairman, is a geopolitical Chernobyl, spewing instability and extremism over the region and the rest of the world. Like a nuclear disaster, the fallout from the meltdown of Syria threatens to be with us for decades, and the longer it is permitted to continue, the more severe the damage will be.
General Petraeus, with his doctorate from Princeton in a crisply laundered uniform, went on to tell the senators that he would advise proceeding with caution.
I do not make recommendations for any kind of military action lightly. But inaction can also carry profound risks and costs for our national security. We see that clearly today in Syria. And Russia's recent military escalation in Syria is a further reminder that when the U.S. does not take the initiative, others will fill the vacuum.
Is a confrontation with Russia the only way to prevent the situation in Syria from getting worse? Major General Paul Eaton trained the new Iraqi army from 2003 to 2004, retired from the army after 33 years of service in 2006. Eaton says that in part due to a failure to achieve goals during the years when General Petraeus was in command, there are very limited options in Syria right now.
Well, John, at the end of the day, we've got a huge political problem that we have not addressed, must address. And it's a political solution that's going to get the final outcome here. Right now, the Air Force is doing what it does very well. It's providing close air support. It's doing so without the forward air controllers that that we like to apply on the ground, the JTACs. They're still accomplishing a lot, but not to the degree that we would like to be able to walk away with. As far as the political solution, you know, we've seen the Russians enter the game right now. We have seen a change in the prime minister, the problem child of al-Maliki, has gone away. We've got al-Abadi in, who may attempt to reverse the disenfranchisement of the Sunni population that is really at the root of this entire problem that we have. There are things moving, but we have not achieved a comprehensive, overarching political solution to the problems of the area.
You trained the Iraqi army from 2003 to 2004. And I suspect you had better results than whatever they did to train the Syrians to fight Bashar al-Assad. I guess something like $500 million, and they only got five people to actually fight. It seems to me that you have even less to deal with, to work with in Syria than you have in Iraq.
John, from my perspective, you've got to start with viable units and that exist now, from populations that will create an armed force that that does trust its chain of command and its political institutions. That will attract Syrian citizens to come into, and you can build them into small units. We've done this before in Korea, where you develop small units of Syrian citizens and grow them in the fabric of a viable ground force that that can fight today. And right now, we're trying to develop independent Syrian units. And from my perspective, that's simply not going to work. It's too early for that.
Won't that create more sectarian problems in Syria if we rely on the Kurds to save the day?
Well, it can. But I trust the Kurds to do the right thing. My experience with the Kurdish leadership, they will do the right thing. Their units right now, the Peshmerga, are viable units. They are trustworthy men. and I believe that they will do the right thing.
David Petraeus, of course, with considerably less credibility, was on Capitol Hill yesterday. Most of that, of course, due to his personal lapses that he apologized for. But I'm just wondering if this entire experience over the last 4 years has just utterly discredited the counterinsurgency theory that, you know, he was selling to anyone who would listen, that all you needed to do was to wander in to Syria and make some friends and win a few hearts and minds, and everything would grow from there. It seems to me that, forget his personal lapses, Petraeus is completely discredited today as a strategist.
There is a place in military strategy for counterinsurgency operations. Some places are a little bit more, some environments are a little bit more difficult than others. We have a problem, and it is an insurgency. And we have got to isolate it, we've got to contain it, and then we have to kill it. The big problem that we have and the big issue that we have failed to address in the past is to install a viable government that will work, that will earn the respect of the citizens to be governed. And that has been the great failing. It is a hugely expensive enterprise that we in the United States have tried to address with the military alone and have failed to address with all the other components of national power that the United States and our allies can bring to bear on the problem. What we have right now, particularly with the immigration crisis in Europe, is a call to arms to the Europeans to go to work and solve a problem that is at their back door. Turkey is a European nation that is astride the Europe and the Middle East zones. And it is the Europeans who have got to come in with a with all the components of national power to help solve the problem that is really going to cause them future great problems.
Before we go, I just have to say, you know, General Petraeus describes this as a geopolitical Chernobyl that is getting worse by the day. You're describing that to even get started here, we have to install a viable political solution in Iraq. That means there needs to be a political solution in Syria as well if Bashar al-Assad is going to go. So we're two governments, two created from zero governments away from getting anywhere in Syria and Iraq. It seems to me that's, you know, way below base camp at Everest.
I will grant you that it's a very serious problem, and it is a very significant enterprise that that needs to be addressed. What we have failed to do, the collective, is recognize that there is one fellow who has an existential threat, and will behave as if he has an existential threat, and that's Bashar al-Assad. If we don't reconcile his situation, if we do not address the fact that Assad, he has nothing to lose. He will do whatever he can to ensure his existence. Failing that, he's going to go the way of Gaddafi. He knows that. So until we truly address the Alawites and Bashar al-Assad, there will be no solution. And that is the beginning of the Russian enterprise right now. The Russians are coming in. The Iranians are already there. At the end of the day, Iraq and Syria may not look the way they did 15 years ago. They may look like something completely different and governed in a way that that we may not be able to see right now.
Major General Paul Eaton trained the new Iraqi army in 2003 and 2004, retired from the U.S. Army after 33 years of service in 2006. Thanks so much, Major General.
John, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
On a lighter note, I suppose, who's that behind the plate? Who's that swinging for the bleachers in the World Series? Who is the face of baseball as a fun game? Come on, this is not a trivia question.
I guess the first thing I should do is thank everybody who made this day necessary.
Yogi Berra made every day he played the game of baseball a reminder that having fun was the necessary ingredient for what was once the undisputed national pastime. And he was good at the game, so very good. 19 years swinging the bat, he struck out only 414 times. That is an insane statistic, and it's just one of many. But Yogi was the opposite of a number. He was a face and a voice and a national mascot, chuckling in the era of the ultra-serious Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, the tragic heroes like Mickey Mantle. And Yogi had something else, stage presence. The camera and the announcers loved him.
Two strikes, ball one. Here comes the pitch. Strike three.
That's right, Don Larsen throws a perfect game in the World Series, but it's Yogi's hug we remember. As baseball and TV began a long relationship in the 50s, Yogi was a star, the working everyman image.
There's probably never been a Yankee that I can think of that probably was said more times to him, well, you can't do that, you can't do that, who then turned around and did it.
Was he a warrior?
Oh, he was a warrior. Oh, was he a warrior.
Longtime Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, who many believe has ended up in a very different baseball hereafter, hotter perhaps. Berra feuded with Steinbrenner for a very long time, but no one could match Yogi's pitch-perfect personality, whose comic timing was as precise as a 5-3-2 double play. Berra appeared in 21 World Series and won 13 of them. He still holds the record for most World Series hits by a healthy margin. And one-liners? No one will ever break that record. When you come to a fork in the road, right, take it.
Who says Yoo-Hoo's just for kids? Yoo-Hoo's for anyone who likes a delicious chocolate drink.
Yogi, what's your call on Camels?
That's easy. Camels taste good and smoke mouth.
Not too close. What do you think? I got that insurance?
What insurance is that, Yogi?
The one you really need to have. If you don't have it, that's why you need it.
Eighth grade education, but with a voice that could sell. And a swing that announced itself the very first time Larry Berra stepped up to the plate.
Berra swings, and that one's going to leave the ballpark. Well, what do you know? Larry Berra, they call him Yogi, his very first time at the plate in the major leagues against the A's. And what does he do? He hits a home run.
Yogi Berra, at age 90, passed away on September 22nd, 69 years to the day of his major league debut. In 1946. So I guess we can be assured that in his first at-bat in the Hereafter League, it'll be a home run. The Volkswagen deception affair has dragged the company's CEO back before the board of the company to explain how software could alter emissions tests and what can be done about it on the 11 million cars that have the flawed system. They could face some of our listeners.
Hey, what's up? It's Simon from St. Louis. What? Volkswagen's not as good as everybody's always thought? I've been saying it for years. Worst car company that comes out of Germany. But wait a minute. They won Car Driver's Car of the Year last year. That'd be like if the team that won the Super Bowl cheated. I can see the headline now. Volkswagen, official car of the New England Patriots.
Some sign of Volkswagen's brand damage out there among our listeners. Simon dripping with sarcasm. Don't deflate your tires in bad weather, Simon, by the way. It won't help you. The scandal raises the question of how we can trust the increasingly digital information displays in all vehicles. Anna Stephanopoulou is a professor of mechanical engineering and director of the Automotive Research Center at the University of Michigan. Anna, with digital displays, is it possible that all of the information that we see is virtual?
No, absolutely not. I think it's necessary to know that there is a lot of effort going on and there are a lot of sophisticated algorithms. But frankly, what it is typically displayed is easy to verify, and it's not necessarily such an easy deception in this particular case or in general in, you know, other cases over the history.
So the deception that Volkswagen carried out here is hard to do, is what you're saying.
Correct. It is very hard. You have to sense, you have to detect, you have to schedule a change in the algorithm and transition from one algorithm to the other seamlessly without the driver and, of course, the EPA or other government agencies that they're watching, you know, can detect.
the inspectors and the mechanics, that sort of thing. I mean, yes. All of that difficulty really just underscores just how premeditated all of this is. Is it possible that other mechanical features that are controlled by computers or at least monitored by computers under the hood could deliver questionable data that would maybe schedule maintenance maybe a little more regularly than is necessary, thereby bringing in more revenue to the company or to the dealers, that sort of thing?
Well, in the United States, we have a system we call onboard diagnostics, and even that system is regulated. So it is necessary to do this right. There are ways of testing them and also writing down in details what they depend on, what signals they get, what information they acquire to actually issue a check engine light or some regular maintenance warning. If you are a very large company, you have to really not be able to do it otherwise, to go this route. What I'm saying is that there must have been a real amazing pressure of time or of some crunch, issuing some models, that this happened. And I'm not trying to justify it, but it might have been that something worked out. And then I guess, did people forget that this amazing thing is happening inside their software as a quick fix?
Wow. As an engineer, what's the buzz about this? I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is this is an absolute shocker. I mean, they really went a direction that no one else is going.
Well, the regulations, both emissions and fuel economy, are getting stricter, and it is harder to achieve these with a low cost. That is plain physics. We are basically manipulating a very hard balance between the fuel consumption and the emissions. And one gives in to the other, and we do find, we innovate and we find solutions that could, create a better balance. But at the end, it is a very hard, equation and a compromise that needs to be made.
Well, you're really describing the trade-off between the fuel efficiency regulations, the emissions regulations, and the interest that consumers have in having cars that, go fast or have a lot of power. Is that a prevailing sentiment?
Yes, yes. In fact, it is a paradox, indeed. So it is true, yes. And I lived through the era that in my country, in Greece, I remember my father, the first time we had the exhaust gas recirculation, he would put a quarter on the valve.
So he'd dismantle it.
Yes, yes, because it was pretty clear that it was cutting back on the power.
Volkswagen, came up with a novel way of getting around this. They're going to be in trouble for it. And too bad we can't come up with a software algorithm that could reduce the amount of emissions in the air. You know what I mean?
Well, in the future, I think interesting things are coming. As I said, there is a lot of research and development. Right now, the algorithms we have in the car are prepared for the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario means that they have a suboptimal, they have to basically, deal with a compromise all the time. So, there's this a lot of hype about autonomous and connected vehicles because you can sit down and relax, that it's a lot about the safety. But I think that that can also be used for fuel economy and emissions.
Well, we'll see as the digital technology encompasses the car completely. There will
yes.
be all kinds of ways of addressing the questions of emissions and fuel efficiency, and not the kind of deceptive techniques that Volkswagen has used here.
That's right. That's right.
Well, Professor, thanks so much.
Sure. You're welcome.
Anna Stephanopoulou is Professor of Mechanical Engineering and Director of the Automotive Research Center at the University of Michigan. We take you now to a legendary live music scene in Nashville. The Holo, a Holo, a Holo, Jemme, Jetele, Jemme, Casora, Hello. Sing it. Musicians Sidka Erizi, Isam Zakoya, and Ahmad Warmali are huge in Nashville, which, in case you hadn't heard, has become the largest community of Kurdish immigrants in the United States. Their success is one of the many songs of assimilation, stories of how between 1970 and 2013, the number of immigrants living in the United States has more than quadrupled, from more than 9 million to over 41 million.
They start small businesses at a faster rate than many native-born Americans. They create jobs.
It's President Obama speaking in Nashville in December of 2014. These immigrants are changing the character of cities all over America, despite popular and distorted arguments to the contrary. A new report finds that immigrants are integrating into American society as quickly and as effectively as in previous generations. And contrary to what a few candidates for president might say, they're also learning English faster than ever before. Joining us is Mary Waters, the lead editor on this new immigrant assimilation study. She's also a professor of sociology at Harvard University. This is positive, interesting, exciting news about the movement of populations in a time when we're hearing so many heartbreaking stories of the movements of populations. Yes?
It is. It's something that we as Americans can be very proud of, that we seem to be integrating immigrants as well as we have in the past.
And when you hear Kurdish music coming out of Nashville, it's a part of all of this that you've been studying.
It is. In fact, it's an example of how immigrants have been moving to places that they had not gone to before. So before the 1990s, immigrants tended to be concentrated on the East and the West Coast and in the Southwest. And in the last few decades, they've moved to places throughout the South and the Midwest and the Far West that they had never been to before.
And some of the challenges here, you can vanish in a big city like New York or Chicago if you're an immigrant or even an immigrant community. But in some of these rural towns, you become a sizable percentage of the population. And so the embrace has to be more deliberate on the part of the people who are there. There's more of an overt sense of welcoming that has to take place for this to work.
That's true, yes. When immigrants go to places where they haven't been before and where you're not used to immigrants coming in, you need to you recognize them, and sometimes it's a bit rocky at the beginning, but over time, people begin to really embrace the newcomers who have come.
Is there an ethnic breakdown as to how this assimilation takes place? Who's doing a better job? What infrastructure is working out better for different groups?
Well, people come at very different starting points. So about 25% of immigrants now come with a college or an advanced beyond college degree. So they have generally an easier time integrating in terms of their education, their income, and their children tend to do well. And then many immigrants come, especially immigrants from Latin America and Mexico, come with very low levels of education. And while their children do a lot better than the parents, so the average Mexican child reaches an education of 12 years, which is a lot more than their parents, they don't necessarily catch up in one generation to native-born Americans because they started at such a low level. But what we find is that for all immigrants, there is progress either in the immigrant's lifetime or for the second or third generation.
How does the very different political situation for undocumented immigrants distort the mechanisms for assimilation that you're seeing in this study? We tend to treat undocumented immigrants, I suppose, for a perfectly understandable reason, very, very differently than immigrants who come in the more formalized process.
The undocumented people, how we characterize them was that they are partially integrated. So being undocumented is not stopping them from working, from forming families, buying houses, raising their kids here. In fact, there are over 5 million kids growing up now with an undocumented parent. They're 7% of all kids in our K-12 school system. So they're integrating, but basically by law, there are blocks on their integration so that they are not doing as well as other immigrants. And whether or not that is what we want to have happen, we seem to have partially blocked their integration but not completely blocked their integration. And what we focused on was the effects on their children, 4.5 million of which are citizen children, And we pointed out that there are real costs for these kids growing up with an undocumented parent. They tend to have more psychological problems. They are developing cognitively more slowly than other kids. And they, on average, get a little bit less education than other kids.
Is that the statistic you might point to as the sort of key takeaway from this study to, say, a GOP presidential candidate who's talking about walls and closing the borders and deporting, 11 million people back to south of the border?
Well, I guess I would point to two things. One is that if you're worried about people becoming Americans, speaking English, doing well in America socioeconomically, intermarrying, all of those things, that's not something to worry about. Our study basically finds that immigrants, including the undocumented, are doing well in American society overall. The impasse on immigration has led to a lot of conflicting laws. So some places are giving driver's licenses and in-state tuition to the undocumented. Other places are prohibiting renting to them. So there's all of these different laws in different places. And whether or not that's what the society wants, we didn't take a position on because that's a political question. But scientifically, what we can say is we do have citizen children growing up with these parents, and there is a negative cost that's being paid by these kids.
Mary Waters is the lead editor on a new immigration assimilation study. She's a professor of sociology at Harvard University. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Long before author Ta-Nehisi Coates reminded us of the unpaid debts of American history in his book Between the World and Me that came out this summer, author Sherman Alexie eloquently spoke of a reckoning of violence that awaited America if it was ever to truly understand its history. Both authors make the case in their work that America's predatory history has consumed people in its national sprint to greatness, that those people are not the casual landmarks in some neat historical timeline, but in fact are moral debts that somehow have to be acknowledged if all Americans are to ever have a shared national history. In more than two dozen books, Sherman Alexie has returned to this idea in poetry, film, and most recently a children's book, Thunder Boy Jr. Sherman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
This idea of shared history, of acknowledging the sort of shared understanding of violence on both sides, is really a key to understanding your work and getting it other than just sort of, you know, reading it and going, oh, that's interesting. You know, we really have to deeply take this inside us.
Well, it's an acknowledgement of the legacy and the way in which this shared history of violence continues to have its effects. I think a lot of people seek to deny that something that happened 100 years ago or something that happened 300 years ago still has long-lasting effects and still changes and alters and mutates the way we relate to each other.
And that includes cops, that includes all these police shootings, that it's not so much that, one person went wrong. It's the collective history just sort of there in the background motivating people.
Well, what you hear people say is, well, it's I didn't do anything. You know, I'm not responsible for something that happened 100 years ago. But the fact is that we're all responsible for it and we all deal with the legacy. So when you see a cop shooting, on YouTube, when you see stats about the incarceration rates of African Americans or Native Americans, when you see all this stuff, it is because it happened 100 years ago and continues to happen. Nothing has stopped. It has changed. It has diminished. It has magnified. It has gotten more specific. But the way the country deals with its African American populations and with Native American population remains basically the same. We are still oppressed. We are still subject to racism. We are still living in poverty, living in threat of violence from institutions, still dealing with a white power structure that diminishes us on a daily basis.
Do you sense that a conversation has been stirred up by the events of Ferguson, by the writings of Ta-Nehisi Coates, by some of the speeches that the president gave at the funeral in Charleston?
I think so. I think there's a conversation started. I don't know if that's the right word. Perhaps a screaming match has been started. I think on some level, there's something intellectual and positive going on, but I think the rise of Donald Trump's candidacy, in fact, points to the fact that there's still this really dark belly, this underside to the American population that is focused on racial animosity, in fact, is fueled by racial animosity.
But let's try to put a positive spin on that. The demographics are against old white guys. The numbers are diminishing. America is becoming a more diverse place. And with the violent legacy of our history, we shouldn't expect that group to go gently into their good night. They're going to fight at the end, which could be a sign that the end is near.
But the power structure itself is still as white as it ever was. It's so you can talk about the demographics of the United States changing, but the demographics of the power structure of the United States aren't changing as dramatically. I just read a stat: half of the children under age 5 in the United States are non-white now. So the country is going to be 60-70% brown-skinned in a generation, and if the power structure doesn't change to match that, we are going to be more and more of an apartheid-looking system.
How's that transfer going to take place? I think in Ta-Nehisi Coates' case, he says give up on fairy tales that basically America has to just completely chuck out the window its sense of the moral nation on the hill, the democracy that is the light of the world, that's a bunch of garbage. And the sooner we chuck that out the window, the easier this transfer is going to be. How do you think the transfer is going
to
take place?
Oh, I mean, that's a huge mythology to try to challenge. I don't know if that's even possible. Really, I guess in some ways I'm more of a bureaucrat than Coates is. I think the sheer nature of voting is going to change things. I think it starts with urban areas, of course, and it starts moving out. If you go to an urban area, you're going to find more and more diversity among elected officials. You're going to find more and more diversity among financial leaders, among educational leaders. So I think what's going to happen is simply is that rural areas are going to get smaller and smaller. And the demographics are going to make it pretty impossible for the white power structure to stay the way it is.
Does openness about this history and this violence help? Or am I just, kind of the parrot of the power structure, just sort of speaking on the microphone here, a well-intentioned, white stormtrooper?
And I think that's another difference between Coates and I. I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe in the power of stories to change the world. And I firmly believe in the power of one story to change one life at a time. I see it all the time with my work, with my young adult novel, going into all sorts of diverse communities and speaking to a wide range of people, not only telling a Native American story and having people from vastly different backgrounds relate to a Native American in that way, but also seeing themselves in that character's journey. So it really is about seeing vastly different people as mirrors and recognizing, oh, wait a second, this person and I have a common journey. So I have to believe in that. That's why I wrote the picture book I did, Thunderboy Jr., which is about a kid named Junior who doesn't want to be named after his father anymore. He wants his own name. And his father agreeing to that. The idea to not impose upon your children your entire legacy, to give your children an option to pursue their own dreams and their own names.
And their own history, free of the burdens.
Not free. You're never free of the burden of history.
Okay.
But to dream of a better future.
I see.
To think of a more independent future. The thing is, I have to believe in it because I did it. I left an oppressive reservation system in pursuit of bigger ideas. And while a lot of Native Americans would see me as somehow fleeing Native Americanness, I didn't. I actually fled a place where white culture was completely defining me as a reservation Indian, limiting my possibilities. And now in this storytelling life of mine, I'm a nomad. I'm an old school storyteller wandering the earth.
Freedom through imagination.
Yes.
Not through denial.
Exactly.
Well, it's a profound and optimistic thought. Sherman Alexie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sherman Alexie has written more than 24 books, and his most recent is Thunderboy Jr. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. By Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. Featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. From the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.